Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Last month, R&B crooner John Legend and his wife Chrissy Teigen announced that they lost a child because of a miscarriage. They told the world about it in an Instagram post that was seen by millions. The painful private moment shined a bright light on a very difficult issue experienced by so many families. And tonight, we'll take a look at this complicated and sensitive issue. From miscarriage to SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, and how couples handle it. We begin tonight with Dr. Hugh Mighty, Dean of the College of Medicine at Howard University. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Dr. Mighty, thank you so much for sharing some information with us.
Good evening. It is my pleasure.
So let me first kind of go back to some real foundational things as it relates to a miscarriage. What exactly is it?
So it's miscarriage would be loss of loss of a fetus or a infant before the time when they would be ready to be born. So miscarriages can occur anywhere from when we break pregnancies down by trimesters. We're looking at the very early course of pregnancy. So most of these are going to occur within 12 weeks and some after that before 24 weeks. So once we, between 20 weeks and before, usually we'll term that being a miscarriage.
Mm-hmm. What about what was commonly known as a stillbirth? How does that differ from a miscarriage?
Correct. So a stillbirth usually refers to a fetus, but at a more advanced stage, so beyond that 20-week stage, 24 weeks, sometimes all the way up to term, which would be 37 to 38 weeks, where that fetus dies before it is born. So it dies prior to birth.
Mm-hmm. And finally, with SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, where a child is born and then dies after birth, whether it be a day or weeks or even months after. Talk to me about some detail about what that is, what causes it, how does that come about?
All right, so SIDS itself, and you appropriately identify that it could be within weeks to months. Generally, it's a multitude of causes that could affect it. What we've spent a lot of time trying to do is to at least refine our understanding of things that are not SIDS. So one of the big pushes would be from the March of Dimes, the American Academy of Pediatricians, is to properly put out preventative measures. So, for example, you know, the term back to sleep was coined so that we remember we don't put babies face down, we don't smother them with a lot of pillows and so on and so forth, which could be contributory to what we often confuse as SIDS. Sudden infant death syndrome can be caused by a number of things. Sometimes there are genetic factors. Sometimes they're due to, let's say, premature babies who then later on develop symptoms where they may not breathe on a regular basis, and we just don't catch it. So the ones that we do understand in those terms of common causes, we at least now have a way of trying to put together a program to detect and even intervene, so to prevent or at least lower the rate of sudden infant death.
Mm-hmm. Do we know what may cause sudden infant death?
It really is a multitude of things. There's no one thing to say this is what causes it.
I do want to go back to the miscarriage thing, you know, particularly as we heard in the John Legend and Chrissy Teigen situation. They announced that they were expecting in August. And then they lost the child. They made the announcement on September 30th, a month or so after they first made the announcement. But Talk to me about the complexities of miscarriage, whether it happens early or, in their case, much later in the pregnancy, and what kinds of things could possibly contribute to that.
Boy, that's really a large call. And one thing about, the concept of miscarriages, excuse me, please, the concept is it's sudden. It often has no particular thing that you can put your finger on. One of the things that we do know is many times parents look back and they say, well, we caused that. And in fact, that is far from true. The majority of miscarriages are going to occur because of one, something in nature. Very early miscarriages occur because, you know, if you think of genetics as being sort of a blueprint for building a house, the body has a way of recognizing when something is not being done specifically according to plan. And the answer might be to stop there and terminate itself. And so you may end up with miscarriages from that reason. Other times there can be early things that are at play, such as certain infections that may stimulate the body again to go into hyperdrive and sort of end up resulting in ending that pregnancy early. So there are a multitude of, again, reasons for this to happen. The one thing about these things happening is they're unexpected. And again, because they don't always have a timing. So sometimes, you know, when someone is threatening to miscarry, you may have bleeding, but that's not always the case. A woman may not have bleeding before it leads to a miscarriage. So many times you will end up with a miscarriage out of the blue. It starts out of nowhere and then it just progresses.
Mm-hmm. Are they becoming more common or are we just hearing more about them?
I wouldn't say that they're becoming more common. I think there's certainly a better identity pattern around what we can detect. And our definition of these have changed somewhat because we can detect them earlier and earlier through technology. So I don't know that I would say that they're occurring much more frequently than they used to, but clearly we can detect them earlier and therefore, you know, the knowledge base has grown.
Can you talk to me a little bit about some of those risk factors that could contribute to them?
I mentioned one, which is, again, just simply not having, so genetics would be one. So chromosomal disorders may lead to that. Other things may well be infections. Again, some of these may be subtle, and we don't know the impact of everything that comes along, but some of them might be common infections that we would see that we wouldn't normally think about contributing, but someone ends up with fever and other things, and then they lead on to this. Some of them are infections that are transmitted vertically from mom to the fetus, and that could be at work as well. Less likely causes, and some of the verdict is still out on these, might be a mother's response to stress over time. We all deal with stress differently. We all turn on different responses within the body to what we see. And so you've got, you know, again, the outside things that we try to say maybe could be stress, could be nutrition. Clearly, nutrition affects pregnancy outcomes. And being able to, and the timing of that, right? The timing of all of those things could be impactful.
Hmm. Now, what about some of those kind of, you know, foundational at-risk behaviors, smoking, alcohol, drugs, and the like?
Certainly those lead to, again, an increased incidence of stillbirths, as you pointed out before. Drugs, again, could be at risk. One of the things that we talk about with smoking, for example, there is some increased risk with smoking. Is smoking the majority thing that used to lead to miscarriages? More likely, you know, we saw that smoking led to smaller, tinier babies, which was a risk factor, most again with preterm birth. But when we use the term sort of miscarriage, meaning in that very, very first early stages of pregnancy, it may not be as big a factor. It certainly is a factor, but not nearly as big a factor as you think about later on.
So if because I know a lot of times, you know, when we talk about, you know, some of the, you know, the many, you know, health disparities, particularly with, you know, with communities of color, do we see that as some kind of contributing factor?
I think that, again, you can see more the bigger picture comes later on in pregnancy, where disparities, inequities, medical conditions contribute a lot more to those poorer outcomes. When you talk about miscarriages in that first, again, below that 28 week of pregnancy, the factors are going to be there, but some of them, again, it's hard to put your finger on them, because more than 50% of miscarriages are going to be because of some genetic chromosomal issue. And the rest are so spread that we couldn't go out and say, well, it's like actually this that makes that happen.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in the case of Chrissy Teigen and John Legend, I can't imagine any disparities that they may have to deal with. They are wealthy. They are, and we don't know the specifics of the medical care that Chrissy Teigen had, but I think it's, you know, safe to assume that they were watching each and every step of the way.
Correct. But again, we have to sort of think through the actual root causes, right? So you got to go back and say, what's the most common cause for miscarriages? It is genetic. It's nothing that a parent can do, no matter how much you watch, and no matter how careful you are, no matter how wealthy you are, there's nothing you do to reverse genetics, right? So in that particular instance, in that particular pregnancy, in that particular fetus, that's destined to be from the genetics that you may find. Now, beyond that, there are other things that might increase the risk of that, right? So you've got folks who may have medical conditions. Diabetes, for example, is not controlled. I mentioned before things like infections. It's not something that you say this is going to happen because of X, Y, or Z. And those, when I talk about infections, many of those things are, you know, there might be a common virus that you may get that may cause that. So there are a lot of things that could be at play. Some of them are detectable medically, so diabetes, thyroid diseases, those things you can see. Some of them are anatomic, but again, discoverable using technology such as ultrasound. If you've got a cervix or a uterus that's not, you know, what I'd call quote-unquote normal in terms of its own development, that may lead to things. But the majority of these just don't seem to pan out, and they're not sort of driven completely by socioeconomic issues. You know, again, unless we talk about things like really disparate things, like really poor nutrition and poor control of underlying disorders. So, but it's not generally in someone who's watching that you can prevent miscarriage. And I don't want to confuse, you know, that segment that we talk about, miscarriage below 20 weeks, with the larger, bigger picture of preterm birth or very poor pregnancy outcomes, which occur, you know, later on past the stage of viability in fetuses, right, that are driven by so many things that we know about.
Can you talk to us, you know, certainly outside, you know, the physiological difficulties of this, about the impact that this has on women and even more broadly, you know, couples, you know, when, you know, they go through this kind of difficult situation, because you said, you know, it is unexpected.
Absolutely unexpected is the most common thing that there is. When you're pregnant, there's abundance. From the day you know, before you have your revealing party or anything, there is abundance. People are excited about creating a family. With miscarriage, that does not go away. You're the loss experience, the feelings of parents from that loss is not different than if you lose you know, a 20, 30 week old, you know, fetus. It really is still real because your expectations are real. You've bonded. And so the grieving process is something that can't be hurried to begin with. It's acknowledging that this has occurred, that this was a positive thing that occurred, and we can't hurry to get past it. Like, you know, you're going to have another baby and so on and so forth. We must live through the moment. We have to be able to be very supportive as family members, as friends, as providers of care. We really have to make sure that we're supporting folks through the experience. Different people will take different periods of time to come to grips with it and you know, be able to carry it. I don't use the term move on because I don't think you move on. I think you come to grips with it and you kind of then absorb that to think through the other things. But I don't think you can minimize what has occurred, nor should, you know, folks say, well, just kind of get past it.
Would you recommend counseling for something like that? Because it would appear to me that there would need to be a very specialized kind of counseling for something so difficult and so specific.
I think it's going to vary by person, but certainly if the family is having trouble, you know, sort of coming to grips around it all and sort of put it in their own context and resolving, certainly having someone outside to be supportive is very, very helpful, considering, again, the nature of miscarriage, you know, that it's usually just very unexpected. It's not the norm that you would say, you know, this is going to happen. In fact, it's the thing that you think won't happen.
We are talking about the loss of a child during birth, miscarriage, SID, sudden infant death syndrome, of course, the loss of a child afterwards. What are the physiological ramifications, the emotional ramifications for women and more broadly families, how to address this issue? If you have a comment, you can text me, or rather you can hit me up on social media at on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher, or on Twitter at H. Fisher WHUR. You can also inbox me on Facebook. If you have a comment, if you have a question, not taking any calls tonight, we only have a line or two, but if you have a comment or a question, I certainly invite you to reach out to me, and I will certainly ask that question. I want to thank Dr. Hugh Mighty, who is the Dean of the College of Medicine at Howard University. We're going to continue this conversation in just a little bit. We're going to talk to an OBGYN who has dealt with this extremely difficult issue. So stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This discussion continues on SiriusXM in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we are talking about the loss of a child via miscarriage, or perhaps even SID, sudden infant death syndrome. How can couples handle it? My guest now is Dr. Nicole Lee Plenty. She is a board-certified OBGYN who has also had this unfortunate experience. Dr. Plenty, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So, first and foremost, it's my understanding that you do have some good news about a new entry into the family.
Yes, I have a new baby. Well, he's not new. He's 16 months old.
Well, yeah, but you know, you can't send him back. You know, you don't have the receipt now, you know. So you get
that
to keep
true.
It. What's his name?
Harrison.
I like that. I like a name with H's, just like mine. Yeah. So certainly congratulations. But this has been a journey for you. Talk to me about the loss of the child previously. Tell me the story.
So, as you know, and you probably know, I practice OBGYN, but I also am a maternal fetal medicine specialist. So I do only high-risk pregnancies. So I basically diagnosed my own pregnancy. I had my sonographer do my ultrasound, and then a couple of weeks later, I diagnosed my own miscarriage. I just basically went in, and there was no heartbeat. There was no heartbeat, and my hormone level started to drop. So for us to confirm a pregnancy, you get a hormone level drawn, and then 48 hours later, you get that hormone level repeated, and if that hormone level is dropping, that confirms the pregnancy. So that is what happened in my case. I had an ultrasound, no heartbeat, hormone level dropped. I worked all week, and then I had a procedure called a DNC, which is a procedure to remove the inside contents of the uterus, and a procedure I commonly did for patients that had experienced losses. And then I went back to my normal business the following Monday.
But was it normal?
No, it wasn't normal. So, I mean, anytime you deal with a loss, it's surreal at that time. So for me, it was, I was somewhat in disbelief that it happened to me, although I counsel patients all the time and remind them that, hey, in the first trimester, if you're over age 35, a third of those pregnancies can end in miscarriage. But regardless, I knew I was 36, 37 at that time, and I knew the statistics, and I didn't think it would happen to me. So when it happened to me, I was sort of in disbelief and didn't really do anything about it, didn't talk to anybody about it for a really long time, and sort of went on my normal business and seeing patients and going to meetings, and it wasn't until a couple weeks later that I got the grief packet that I prepared for my hospital and broke down. So, no, it was not normal. It wasn't business as usual. And it took my husband and I a really long time to decide that we wanted to have a child, that we wanted to even try again. And a couple years later, we have him. We have Harrison.
This is... You just said something that kind of struck me. You said, you know, you and your husband had to decide whether or not you were going to have a child again. If I know this is really personal, but can you give our listeners an idea of what that conversation was like? Because this obviously was something that you two went through together.
Yeah, the conversation, so my husband doesn't really push the envelope anyway. So he's very laid back. He's a minister. He's, you know, very prayerful. So we have been very prayerful at that time that we could, you know, sort of overcome and work through the grief together, although we were still not really talking about what had happened. And for us, it was a matter of, was I okay? And was I emotionally ready to deal with the things I had to deal with? I mean, I take care of pregnant women every day. So I had to be like, okay, am I okay trying to get pregnant, being a high-risk pregnancy, and taking care of people that are pregnant every single day. So we conversed about the timing, like what was the best timing for us. We did get a preconception visit from my OBGYN, which is interesting because she's a friend of mine. So she was like, well, I'll refer them to you and ask you what to do. So a lot of it was just getting mentally prepared. So there's no, you know, timing besides a couple months after you have a miscarriage. You should basically wait until you get a normal period again. So there's no real restrictions other than that about when to try to get pregnant. It's all about when you're emotionally ready to get pregnant. And so a year later was when we were emotionally ready to say, okay, we're going to try to get pregnant.
You said that you've counseled women who have experienced, you know, miscarriages. How has this experience changed, if at all, how you counsel them?
Well, I've always been pretty thorough in counseling. And so I give people, I'm very direct. My personality is very direct. So if I see something wrong during the pregnancy, I tell people immediately, this is what I see wrong. This is what I'm concerned about. In the first trimester, it's a little different because there's really nothing that you see that's wrong necessarily. Occasionally you do, but most of the time you don't. It's something that just happens, right? Some people have vaginal bleeding. Some people, they come in, the heartbeat stopped. Some people come in, they had a baby before, and then there's nothing in their uterus. So the first trimester is a little different. That conversation is much different than the second and the third trimester. But having experienced a loss, I now share with them that I have a loss. I think that it's, for my patients, it's good to identify people that have experienced a loss. So they ask me questions about how I deal with this. So I usually share that I've experienced a loss. I share with them that they'll get through it, and I share with them that most of the time it's not their fault. And I then follow up with them. So that is something that I've changed. Instead of following up with the patient 2 weeks later, which is what I usually did, now I follow up with them immediately. So if I talk to someone on a Monday, I'm going to call them on Tuesday, because sometimes people don't hear what you're saying. They hear bad news, and then they shut down. And I recognize that. Mm-hmm. So the next day, I'll call them and say, I'm just calling to check on you. I'm calling to make sure you don't have any other questions about anything. I'm calling to make sure you talk to your family. Is there anybody I can call for you? So that I have changed. Other than that, I've been pretty consistent with care. Mm.
You mentioned that your husband was a pastor. You know, besides the fact that you had a mate there to be supportive. Did your faith play a role in the emotional recovery from this experience?
Oh yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. I'm very prayerful. I pray with my patients, if they will allow me to. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, my faith definitely played a role. My husband and I prayed often, and we prayed together, and we looked at scriptures, and because of my faith, I knew that it would be okay. And because of my faith, and because I experienced this with patients before, I knew that, hey, this will be okay. And I have to remind my patients that it'll be okay. And I've seen people have miscarriages and then come back to me a year later with babies that are okay. So my experience and my faith told me that I'll be okay, but it still takes some time to heal.
Mm-hmm. What do you recommend for couples who are going through or have gone through this experience? And do you recommend counseling? I asked the same question of Dr. Hugh Mighty, the dean of the College of Medicine, because it's so specific. How do you recommend that they move through this so that they can be mentally and emotionally healthy?
Yes, I always recommend counseling. So if someone has a loss, and because I'm a high-risk specialist, I'm often diagnosing anomalies in babies as a reason for losses or a reason that they need to be delivered earlier, knowing that those babies, because they're premature, they may have an increased risk of dying after the pregnancy. So if I am seeing signs that this patient is at risk for losing her pregnancy before the point of viability or before 24 weeks, they automatically get counseling. If somebody has had a loss and they come in for a preconception visit for me, with me, I always schedule them for counseling. And the network that I'm in, we're set up in such a way that I automatically have counselors that are dedicated specifically for perinatal morbidity and mortality. So they do get that specific kind of counseling so that they can understand and talk through why this happened and understand that, hey, after you do your part, you have to realize that none of this caused this to happen. And then I also recommend some preconception counseling to make sure all the comorbidities are under control, right?
Such as?
Because if you have comorbidities like diabetes or high blood pressure or you have obesity or any other medical problem, that can affect a future pregnancy. So my job is to help people navigate all the way through the pregnancy and get there safely. And their best chance of getting a healthy baby the next time around is if they optimize their care before they get pregnant. So I literally run down a checklist. So if you have diabetes, we don't want you to get pregnant until your hemoglobin A1C is at 6%. If you have high blood pressure, you can't take these type of medicines because these type of medicines can lead to birth defects. So I need you to come off of those and switch to some that are compatible with pregnancy before you get pregnant. So we won't have that issue of birth defects. And I need your blood pressure to be at goal before you get pregnant.
At
if
goal?
You're obese, at goal, meaning I need you to be as close to 130 over 85 or under as possible. And that can be with or without medication. So that is the goal to get pregnant.
It seems to me, however, you know, when you talk about all of these factors, and I mentioned this to Dr. Mighty as well, that some of the things that you're discussing, comorbidities, are disparities that are particular to African Americans. And yet, as we know, in the case of John Legend and Christy Teigen, for example, that, I think it's safe to assume that they had every kind of resource available to them. And yet this happens. And so this is such a mystery. And even, someone with your level of expertise, I'm sure it's still difficult to predict.
It's extremely difficult to predict. So the truth is, if you're early in the pregnancy, in the first trimester, and you're over age 35, that's considered advanced maternal age. There's about a 25 to 30% chance that you're going to lose your pregnancy. It's just what it is. And half of those, we don't even know why you've lost them. And then out of the known causes, the majority of those can be because of infection or can be because of anomalies that we can't yet see or can be because of chromosomal abnormalities. So if you're talking about early in pregnancy, yeah, there's a big part that's very unpredictable. With Christy Teigen's miscarriage, that was unfortunate because she would seem to be a little bit further along. We don't know exactly how far along she was because I don't see that data. And we don't know exactly what the cause was, but we do know that she had bleeding throughout the pregnancy and she had multiple blood transfusions. So her situation's a little bit different, right? So if you have blood, like bleeding in the pregnancy, where's the blood coming from? So could you have blood because you have a separation of the sac away from the inside of the uterus? Could you have a separation of the placenta from the inside of the uterus? So depending on what gestational age she was or how far along she was in pregnancy, that would tell us about the bleeding. And then there's a couple of other complications in pregnancy that can cause bleeding that then increase your risk of a miscarriage. So Christy Teigen's situation was very unique. It wasn't just a first trimester, you were pregnant, you had nothing going on, and then you miscarried. She had some complications throughout her pregnancy.
How long have you been practicing?
I've been practicing since 2009.
Okay, so 11 years. In your practice, have you noticed that this is happening more frequently or less frequently? With all of the medical advances that we have, we know that pregnancy remains a high-risk medical situation. Certainly, even the best pregnancies are touch and go. But have you noticed this happening more or less?
No, I don't think it's happening more. The data shows us that over the last 4 years, the miscarriage and stillbirth rate, meaning the rate at which you lose a pregnancy less than 20 weeks versus the rate of losing a pregnancy at all after the 20th week, has gone down. The thing that stayed steady is the rate in African Americans. That's still twice as high as it is in Caucasians. We don't really know why that is, because if the numbers are overall improving and ours aren't, then that's a problem. And we can blame it on things like health disparities, but no one else's health disparities have changed. They still have health disparities too. and everybody else isn't improving, and we're not. So what's really going on? I mean, there's some systemic things that are going on there. It could be some of the health disparities. And then we know that people are having children older, which can cause you to have an increased risk of loss. But overall, no, the numbers are not increasing. For black people, they're steady. Mm-hmm. But overall, they have actually decreased.
So for those, you know, couples who are trying to plan, what would you recommend that they do to have the healthiest pregnancy and taking, you know, the baby to term?
So, one, sometimes even everything you do, you still can have a bad outcome. So, one, they have to know that. There is always a chance at any point in the pregnancy that you can have a bad outcome, and the risk is highest in the first trimester. So for people trying to plan, realize that there's a risk, and then two, make sure you have a preconception consult on both ends. And that could be with your OBGYN, it could be with your family medicine doctor, it could be with the nurse practitioner, or it could be with a maternal fetal medicine specialist like me. And that visit is to make sure that you are healthy. I think that people get pregnant and they don't go to the doctor, and then they find out that they have stuff later on and while they're pregnant. That's not the time to find out you have a medical problem. The time to find out you have a medical problem is before you get pregnant. And that's the biggest thing that people can do to help themselves get through the pregnancy safely. The other piece I would tell people to do is to make sure that they're asking questions and getting answers. So you shouldn't leave your doctor's office without knowing the answer to all your questions. So make sure you get the answers to your questions when you ask them. And then thirdly, make sure you don't ignore your own symptoms. So if you're not feeling right, don't ignore the feeling that you have. If you're a husband and your wife doesn't look right, don't ignore that. Reach out to your OBGYN if you are pregnant and tell them, hey, my wife is not looking right. If you don't feel well, go to the triage. Go to OB triage or go to the ER. Get checked out when you're pregnant. You can't wait 3 or 4 weeks until your next prenatal visit sometime. And I think that some women, myself included, will just sort of kind of suck it up. Like, oh, I'm dizzy right now, but I'm going to suck it up. Or, oh, my baby's not as active, but I'm going to just, you know, I'll wait a little while and see if I can feel the baby move. No, I mean, you really do need to be proactive during the pregnancy and making sure that if you don't feel well, you know what's going on pretty urgently.
And I think that sounds important, particularly for women who have never been pregnant before, because I would imagine they don't know what is normal and abnormal. And for some women, the whole process may feel different, uncomfortable, and the like. And then for others, you have, you know, as we know, there are some women who say, I had a wonderful pregnancy. And so, right. You know, how do you gauge what does and does not feel right?
Right. And so if it's your first pregnancy, you're right. You're not going to know. But you should ask. And you should have an explanation. So if you have a headache is never normal in pregnancy. You should always tell somebody you have a headache. And you should take Tylenol. And if it doesn't go away, you should go in to get checked out. You know how you're supposed to feel without being pregnant. So if you feel differently, that's when you ask, is this normal to feel this way? And don't assume it's normal because, oh, my aunt told me it's normal, or my mom said she had those same symptoms when she was pregnant, so it's not that big of a deal. No, always double check and say, hey, I'm having a lot of heartburn. Is that normal? Hey, I'm having a lot of pain in my back and in my belly. Is that normal? So just to make sure it's normal, because pain in pregnancy can be a very normal thing, or it can be disastrous. And there's no way to know if it's normal or not without me doing a physical exam on you and looking at your baby and making sure that placenta or the afterbirth looks normal. So if somebody calls me and says, I have pain, and I'll ask them to describe the pain, because I'm thinking, is it contractions? Do they have abdominal pain and something's going on with their afterbirth? Are you having movement normal? So I assess based on what they're saying whether it's something I need to see them in person for. So that they're describing like vague lower abdominal pain. Okay, well, if you're feeling active movement and you're not contracting, then that's not a big deal. Take some Tylenol, take some Benadryl, get some rest, call me if it worsens. But if you are describing to me something that as a professional, don't think is normal, then I need to see you to tell you whether or not it's normal or not.
You said that you and your husband had to have a conversation about whether or not to try again. Why did you have that conversation as to whether or not to try again?
Well, honestly, I had a lot of issues with my pregnancy with my son, Harrison. And I didn't have those issues before when we had the first pregnancy. But the conversation about whether to try again after the miscarriage was literally because I wanted to make sure we were mentally okay, because if you're not mentally there and you happen to have another miscarriage, because, like I say, any pregnancy can end in miscarriage, especially in the first trimester. You don't really breathe lightly until you get in the second trimester. It's, hey, are we ready for the possibility that something could happen? Mm-hmm. And we both had to come to grips with being mentally prepared to accept whatever is going to happen with the next pregnancy.
How did you know when you were mentally prepared to try again?
I don't know. I mean, I think I knew because you just get that itch.
And okay.
I said, you know what? It's time for me to have a baby. But, you know, there's no, like, aha moment, you know? I didn't have an aha moment. It was just like, okay, well, I'm not getting any younger. I'm seeing all these people with babies. I'm now looking at baby stuff. And so for me, I was ready. That may be different for different people, right? So for some people, they're like, okay, well, that wasn't a good time, and I need to be financially ready, or I need to make sure I have the support that can, you know, come in and help us clean, or I have a job that will allow me to take time off. I mean, different people have different reasons that they're ready. For me, I didn't have any of those other factors. It was literally getting mentally prepared. And honestly, about a year went by and I was like, you know what? I'm ready to have a baby. And my husband said, are you sure? And I said, yeah.
Did he have to be ready?
I think yes. Yes, I think so. I think that for my husband, I'm sure that he dealt with the loss hard, right? Just as I did. But we probably processed things a little bit different. One, he's not in the medical field. And two, he, you know, had a lot more questions than I had. Like for me, I was like, this just happened. You know, it's emotional, but it just happened. For him, he probably had a lot more questions than I had because he doesn't know that those kind of things just happen. Even when after I had my ultrasound, I told him, I think that this is probably going to be a miscarriage. I'm going to go back and get my hormone level done. He said, you know, well, you know, the God I serve. And I said, listen, don't go there, because God allows people, good people, to go through things too. So we can't think that way. And he said, you're right. You're absolutely right. God does not, does allow you to go through things. And so when it happened, he seemed okay. But, you know, you never know what somebody is going through deep down inside. You don't. And so, yeah, I do think it was, it's good to make sure your spouse is okay. And I do think that if a wife has a miscarriage or a woman has a miscarriage, they should ask their significant other, hey, are you okay? Because you're both grieving, although that grief may be different and be in different ways.
I've got about a minute or so left. What is the best advice, you know, mentally that you can give to couples who are who may be listening to this and are anticipating a pregnancy or maybe pregnant now?
The best advice I can give anybody listening is just to take everything one step at a time, right? Be prayerful and hope for the best and just accept and ask questions when you get information. And I say that because some people get information and they try to shut the information out or they only hear one piece of the information. Take notes, write the information down, and follow up with that information. But realize that once you get through that first trimester, the risk of loss is a lot lower, and understand that it's not your fault. That's a big thing that parents don't understand. It's not your fault.
Well, I want to thank you for, you know, talking to us, Dr. Plenty, about, you know, this really a difficult subject. I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who are, you know, just kind of wondering, you know, how to, you know, move, you know, beyond it, because it is something that they may, you know, obviously never forget. And even those who are concerned about, you know, the ramifications of it possibly happening to them, you know, no matter what their, you know, their age group, it's certainly important to consider all of the factors, comorbidity, where you and your partner may be, you know, emotionally as you move through this. So I really want to thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. We also want to thank Dr. Hugh Mighty, Dean of the Howard University College of Medicine, for also sharing in this conversation. That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, October 19th. I'm Harold Fisher. Coming up next, Unheard with Wes. We'll see you tomorrow. Good night.